Painful. You probably didn't know that word before, huh? Lumen Vitae is the parent corporation for Women's Answer Medical Center, which is our crisis pregnancy center. And it's also the parent corporation for Hope Renewed, which is our new post-abortion counseling ministry, which we're hoping to get, take off. On behalf of the board of directors, I would like to welcome all of you to this workshop. The theme of our workshop is A Time for Mercy. And this is very appropriate, right? Since the Holy Father declared this the year of mercy, we thought it was the right time to launch our Hope Renewed ministry. And we want to make people aware of the healing that is needed after an abortion. When we discussed our strategic plan among the board members, we proposed that we would do this ministry in kind of stages. So the first stage began in February at our Banquet for Life. Our keynote speaker was Vera Lord, and she told us the tremendous suffering that she experienced after her abortion and how it led her into drugs and alcohol abuse. Then after many painful years, God brought people in her life and organizations such as Project Rachel and Rachel's Vineyard to help her deal with her grief and bring her back to wholeness. The second stage of this launch occurred in March. We organized a public awareness session at St. Augustine Catholic Church in Gainesville. It was entitled Abortion Healing in the Year of Mercy. This informational session was geared towards college-age men and women who wanted to know more about the psychological effects of abortion. This workshop is kind of our stage three of our strategic plan. It was initially geared solely for healthcare professionals who might be interested in counseling post-abortive men and women. However, after speaking with Dr. Rue, I realized that we needed to open up the workshop to non-medical people. And so here we are, all of us, medical and non-medical together. And we hope you will learn a lot from our speakers and that you will consider becoming a part of our healing ministry. In January, we will be having a Mass of Remembrance here at the Shrine. And if you have any friends or family members who have lost children, either by miscarriage, abortion, or whatever, please tell them about this special healing Mass. Now, I just want to say something. I went Thursday night to a Banquet for Life for another crisis pregnancy center in Gainesville. And the woman sitting next to me was African-American lady, and she was from another denomination. And I was wearing a bracelet like this, you know, and she looked at it and she goes, "Oh, are these all your family members?" And I said, "Well, they're saints of the Catholic Church, but yes, they are my family members, you're right." And so I consider you all my family members too, because all you pro-life people who stand up for life we're all members, right, of the same family, right? So, okay, without further ado, I would like to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Vincent Rue. He received his PhD in child development and family relations from the University of North Carolina at Greensboro and has over 35 years of counseling and consulting experience working with individuals, couples, and families. Dr. Rue has also served on the faculties of California State University at Los Angeles and the United States International University in San Diego. He is a special consultant to the Pontifical Academy for Life and the U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops Pro-Life Secretariat. He is also a researcher and author of 38 professional publications. He's just returned from Russia. Maybe he'll mention something about abortion situation in Russia. And we please welcome Dr. Rue to our small little parish.
Thank you very much, Phil. I'm delighted to be here today, and I'm just very delighted to see so many faces here and to turn up on a Saturday morning. That's awesome, and to be interested in this topic. So thank you for coming, and thank you for your interest. To spare you having to write a lot of stuff down, I have handouts for you. I will give those to you afterwards, so you can take them home. And they're excellent for falling asleep by. You can read them if you're tired, you can fall asleep. But it's got studies in here and links and all sorts of things. So I just want to tell you they're there and not to worry about grabbing all those notes. Okay. As Phil said, my work in the last, well, really since before Roe v. Wade, I should tell you just a little bit about myself. Father Paul Marx was my mentor in undergraduate studies at St. John's University. He wrote the first book on abortion in America called Abortion Death Peddlers. And Father Paul Marx went on to found Human Life International. And little did I know at the time that I was, you know, preparing for really a career in this, because he went, as a sociologist, he went to the first strategy session in California that looked at how can we make abortion legal in this country. And he took copious notes, and The Death Peddlers is all about that. And I was his research assistant, helping put all that together. I went on to St. Louis University and studied under Dr. William Brennan, who is an ethicist who examined what happened in the Third Reich in Nazi Germany. And he wrote two books on medical ethics in the Third Reich. And again, I helped him with that work. And I had no idea how all of this was coming together, but lo and behold, the next step was on to the University of North Carolina. And there, I was a research assistant to Dr. Richard Clemmer, who had founded a teenage parents program. And he also did a lot of counseling for girls and women who had unwanted pregnancies. So I reported in for duty my first day as his research assistant. And I opened the door, and he was slumped over his desk. He had died of a heart attack. And so they said, well, we want you to take his program. So it was a baptism of fire. And through all of this, I kept wondering, where is all of this going? And because at that point, the legalization of abortion had already occurred in Hawaii and California, but Roe hadn't been decided at that point. And then suddenly it was, and then the university participated in a program that helped women in the community by looking at all options, including abortion. And they asked me to do research with that group. And that's really how I started in this. And women that elected, after having counseling, to go and have an abortion, this was in 1974, women who elected to go to these abortions, I sat in on interviews, I was gathering data, and then we did post-abortion evaluations. And what we found was women that came back from their abortions were devastated. And yet this was a choice they made. And that was a very difficult thing for for the medical community, the psychological community, to understand. We also found that at the time, the decision outcome influenced, that is, if she decided to have an abortion, it was largely based upon a decision that she made before she even had counseling. So it was like too late. People had already influenced her. Her decisions were already made. So that was the beginning, and it stretched back a few years. There's a lot in between, but it's not about me today. It's about my favorite topic, which is abortion and mental health. So Phil mentioned that I have just come back from Russia. I was over there a couple of weeks ago. It was my third trip. And in this country, I unfortunately have been tagged as infamous. But when I got over there, they said, oh, Dr. Roo, you're famous here. I said, what? I was over there doing a study in 2000, and we published in 2004. And that's the only study that has been done in the Russian Federation on the psychological aftermath of abortion. Imagine, there were years in Russia where there were 30 million abortions in 1 year. Abortion had been legal since 1920. Lenin said, we need women to be free to work for the state, not to be encumbered by pregnancy or family responsibilities. And so, so dedicated were the Bolsheviks that they actually created the suction machine that's still in use today. Did you know that? The Bolsheviks did. The Bolsheviks are long gone. But after Lenin came Stalin, and Stalin realized we're losing a lot of human beings. So he made abortion illegal. But by that time, people were very used to aborting. And so in the early 60s, in this former Soviet Union, they asked psychologists, they asked physicians, to propagandize, to come up with materials. And we could spend a lot of time on this, but I'm just going to briefly tell you how to dissuade people to not have abortions. And they had big posters and showed the devastation of abortion and, you know, unbelievable symbolism. Well, that worked to some extent, but not well enough. So then they decided, well, rather than have it be illegal, they'll let it be legal again. So it became legal again. And it was really only until Putin started putting the brakes on it, and not, I think, who knows his true motivation? I can't speak for him. But one thing is clear. Russia, as we know it, is dying. There are no more... They call it a demographic winter. There aren't enough babies being born. They can't replenish their population. And so, I thought it's very strange. They invited me to come in and talk with them about how my research can influence people when they consider abortion. And they want to set up improved counseling format around the country so that all the information about the psychological health risks and the physical health risks of abortion can be disclosed. Over there, they have 30% of women have complications from abortion. Some 20% of women become infertile after abortions. So it's a real problem. And having gotten used to having abortions, they have had more abortions. And as they've had more abortions, physicians push abortions. So it's going to require a major amount of re-education and information, but it's a tremendous opportunity. And what I find paradoxical is, considering this country, we want to be like Russia. We do. That's what, if the Clinton administration gets in, she wants abortion unrestricted, paid for by the state, available on every corner, as Trudeau does in Canada. We want to be like Russia. That's the only country that's done this. And this is a little big secret, that it doesn't work. You depopulate, and as you do, you create horrible mental health problems that keep people from getting into relationships, having successful relationships, and having children, and keeping the country going. So, all right, by way of introduction, my questions, whoops, the questions today that I want to pose here are, first, what are the mental health outcomes of abortion? Two, what are the risk factors for these psychological problems? Three, does it look like, can we call it trauma? And what is its clinical course? And four, what can you do to help? Well, this slide to me says 1,000 words. Abortion is everywhere. There's probably no home in America that hasn't been touched by abortion. We all have friends, we all have relatives, somebody has had an abortion. And in Russia, you know, as I spoke to a large group of people, everybody almost had an abortion, or multiple abortions. One of the psychologists there told me that she talked to a woman and helped her who had 40 abortions. And I thought, wow. It wasn't uncommon in our study to see 8 and 10 abortions in one woman. So Since the legalization of induced abortion in 1973, there have been some 50 million terminations in our country, most of which are largely invisible, unspoken, but not recognizable, and not unremarkable memories in a woman's and man's reproductive history. In many respects, despite over four decades of legalization, the personal experience of abortion today remains largely hidden, much like its psychological sequelae. And why is that? Well, there are probably three good reasons to avoid talking about abortion. The first one is we're afraid of death. There's no faster way to stop a conversation than to start talking about death. And there's no topic more capable of evoking sheer terror and psychological flight than consideration of one's own demise or one's child. Some women report that they feared for their lives during their abortion. Others could feel that part of them was slipping away on the table, that part of them had died. And I hear this often. Also, that it's a fear of failure. And you know, the culture of death is not so much about dead, it's about making people dead. It's a culture of fear about, I can't prevent death. I have to choose this for my sake, for the family's sake, for the state's sake, whatever. So abortion, by most accounts, next to war, is considered a profound human failure. While the abortion decision is intensely personal, it is also uniquely social, in that one's offspring, the next generation, is intentionally destroyed. Also is the fear of rejection, because the need for acceptance is an intimate part of our emotional core as human beings. We do many things to gain the acceptance of our parents, our friends, our colleagues, our children, our bosses, our employees. But at the core of the power driving this need for acceptance is the opposite, namely the fear of being rejected, of not being accepted. And thus, abortion is encapsulated. One's abortion experience, be it female or male, is encapsulated largely in these three fears. Now, these are my basic assumptions that I have gleaned over the years, and they are as follows. First, the patient's perception of abortion is what matters. That is where we begin, not what is politically correct or expedient. Too many patients' feelings and beliefs are simply dismissed by healthcare providers. This is a horrible tragedy in this country, where our major American health organizations, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the AMA, the APAs, the Psychological and Psychiatric Association, they are all on board supporting, advocating unrestricted abortion rights. In fact, the American Psychological Association says this is a human right. So if it's a human right, then it's a wrong to not have that right available. So consequently, when people go for help, if they're not asked the question about their pregnancy loss, they're not going to say anything because of those fears. They're not proud of what they had to do or felt they needed to do. So they either are discouraged from talking about their abortion experience because they're not questioned, or if they do summon the courage to talk about it, the counselor The physician, the pastor, simply says, I haven't heard of that. It must be your issue. And it blames the victim, which is an old technique that's gone back for centuries. Blame the victim for suffering from going through a procedure that is legal, that is supposedly something that's going to provide benefit. So it is true in terms of my experience that abortion is a violent and intentionally caused human death event, which for some can be experienced as traumatic and can cause serious and lasting adverse mental health outcomes. Abortion is certainly intentional, and indeed, if fetal death does not incur, a provider can be sued for malpractice. So it has to be a successful abortion, which means death. If abortion is perceived as violating one's moral code or religious values, a moral injury can occur with its attendant sequelae. What does that mean? A moral injury where we act against our core beliefs. In the psychological literature, this is called cognitive schemas. When we do this, it affects us in ways that we haven't really known about. And what's fascinating is if we just leave this domain of abortion for a minute and focus on U.S. veterans coming back from the Middle East wars, we see all of these suicides going on. 20 a day. I think there are more suicides now than there have been fatalities. Who's killing American soldiers? They are. Why? Because of a moral injury. We know about PTSD, but PTSD doesn't tell the whole story. And this is just emerging as a construct to be studied and is actively being studied right now. But moral injury suggests that when we violate our core beliefs, it changes us, it diminishes us, and it disempowers us. So, in short, moral injury can result from a serious transgression, which leads to serious inner conflict based upon shame and guilt, because the experience is at odds with and does not conform to one's core ethical and moral beliefs. Now, one of the things that's happened in the last 25 years is anyone talking on this subject has had formerly to rely upon anecdotal information, small sample sizes, but in the last 15 years, we see now studies on the psychological aftermath of abortion that are large, having thousands of women. Many are nationally representative. We see pre-abortion mental health statistically controlled. Multiple controls are instituted in the methodological design. Prospective data, long-term longitudinal data is collected. Use of appropriate control groups and others, all of which significantly improve the evidence that I'm going to present. Past research says approximately 10 to 30% of women suffer mental health problems after an abortion. These include depression, anxiety, substance abuse, PTSD, suicidal ideation, and attempts. The controversy. Does elective abortion carry increased mental health risks compared to childbirth? And here we see three, and there's probably four or five of these now, but these are the ones that I think are classically quoted. The American Psychological Association has taken the lead and promoting there are no psychological after effects of abortion any different than when a woman has delivers a child. So therefore, be at peace. All is well. This is the same group that tells us abortion is a human rights issue. And they did that in 1968, before Roe versus Wade, which is amazing. So you have this advocacy organization trying to be objective and have it both ways. And guess what? It's not happening. So their report on the after effects of abortion, I could go through a criticism of it, but if you want to read it, you're welcome to. But I'm just going to say at this point, it's biased. It's was not inclusive of all studies. The report members were very biased. No one with a opposite opinion was even asked to participate. So, you know, you stack the deck, and the APA has done this before. It's not uncommon, and you end up coming up with the conclusion that you actually wanted. So, a better way to look at a literature review is to do a meta-analysis. Now, what is this crazy thing? Some of you, I'm sure, know this, but let me just speak to this for a second. Rather than just look through the studies and do what's called a systematic analysis, which is what these folks did, these are all systematic analyses where they look at all the studies and they list them and they rate them based upon some criteria or some criteria that aren't even known. For example, in the American Psychological Association study, after looking at 50 studies, they concluded their conclusions are based on one study. And that was a 1987 study in Great Britain that had significant methodological problems. Anyway, a meta-analysis basically takes and combines the outcomes of different studies and statistically looks at this as an effect size and compares one study to a group of all these studies merged into an effect size and comes up with an odds ratio of whether or not the comparison of a chance event is occurring in one group as opposed to that of it occurring in another group. So the odds ratio is a measure of effect size. And there have only been four meta-analyses that have been done in the history of legal abortion in the United States. The first one was ours back in 1987. And I'm not going to spend much time on that. And the second was done in 1990. But the two most recent ones are Ferguson and Coleman. And these are the ones you need to know about. Coleman analyzed data on 877,181 women. 163,831 experienced an abortion. Women having abortion experienced an 81% increased risk of mental health problems. Now, this was published in a little pro-life magazine, right? Wrong. This was published in the British Journal of Psychiatry. Preeminent world's top psychiatric professional journal. It would never be published in the United States because in the United States, you can't get things published. We have to go outside. But the British Journal of Psychiatry. Now, there was a horrendous backlash of people writing saying this is terrible, methodologically flawed, blah, blah, blah. But guess what? It was seriously peer-reviewed and peer-reviewed with multiple reviewers. and it stood the test. It was published. It hasn't been retracted. 81% increased risk of mental health problems. Abortion carries increased risk for anxiety disorders, 34%. Depression, 37%. Alcohol use and abuse, 110%. Marijuana use and abuse, 220%. And suicide behaviors, 155%. So incredibly, of all mental health problems examined, you could take 10%, and this is a national study, you could take 10% of all of those problems away if women didn't elect induced abortion. That's called a population attributable risk, or population attributable fraction. That's a whopping figure. Ferguson, 2013, when compared to unwanted or unintended pregnancy, abortion moderately increases risk of mental health problems. He found 28% increased risk for anxiety disorders, 134% for alcohol misuse, 291% for illicit drug use, and 69% increased risk of suicidal behavior. Remember we talked about suicide earlier? Gisler in Finland did a study 8 years now ago on all women in Finland. They have a national data register. And so you can't say, well, it's just a few. It's the whole, all Finnish women. They looked at all of the mental health data, all of the medical data of women who've had abortions. And he found 6-fold increase of suicide, 6-fold for women who elected abortion. Now, in subsequent studies, he's reduced that down. He's carrying a 2-fold increased risk, but still, it still stands. Abortion and suicide, it's dangerous. And Ferguson lastly said, there is no evidence to suggest that rates of mental health problems were lower in women having abortion than in comparison groups of women having unwanted pregnancy, irrespective of study quality. I'm going to just skip these two. So here's what we know. There is insufficient evidence confirming abortion's psychological safety. There is an absolute ethical dictum in medicine that says, first, do no harm. Primum non nocere. And so we have this intervention called elective abortion, but we have no studies confirming that it is psychologically safe. Indeed, Ferguson, this guy back here, whoops, where did he go? He went away, there he is. Ferguson is an interesting character. He is one of the top researchers in the world on child abuse. And I've known of his work for years. He's a top methodologist, highly regarded. He's published hundreds of studies, top journals around the world. When he published his first paper on abortion, which was in 2006, he couldn't get it published. He was shocked. He even included that in the article. He said, what? My credentials, and he's pro-abortion, by the way, pro-choice. He couldn't get it published because it didn't fit the confirmatory bias, the institutional bias of our society, of the journals, of the professional associations. So, if he had trouble publishing, imagine what we have. So it's a real challenge. Okay. There is no credible evidence documenting abortion's mental health benefits. That's kind of scary. We've had 50 million of these procedures. The benefits, please. Abortion is contraindicated when undertaken for mental health reasons. I can't tell you how many people I've treated and how much research I've seen that suggests if there is one thing I will bet $1 million on right here, right now, if I had it, and that is if there is mental fragility in a woman pre-abortion, that will predict post-abortion emotional injury. You can take that one to the bank. That is an absolute known fact. And yet, are women screened? Are women protected? No. If they are, it's on a piece of paper. They just check a box. I remember sitting in on a deposition of an abortion provider in the state of Wisconsin on an informed consent case. I helped the attorney general up there years ago. And the abortion provider, when asked, what do you do when a woman is in the stirrups and you're preparing for the abortion? What do you do? And she said, well, I prepare this, and then I have these forms next to me, and I'm filling these out with medical data. And the question was asked, is there anything else on that form? And she said, yeah, there's a question about PTSD. And they said, why do you have PTSD on there? She said, because women, when they're undergoing abortion, often regress and start making sucking noises, will suck their thumbs, or try and tuck into the fetal position. That's from an abortion provider. She ought to know. She's now deceased, but I thought that was incredible. You'll never read about that, but there, from the mouths of the experienced ones. So abortion can actually place one's mental health at risk, and untreated traumatic stress complicates and thwarts grief reactions. Okay, so most abortions in this country are provided by our friends at Planned Parenthood. And over the years, they keep changing what they say about the emotional after effects of abortion. And this is what they currently say. You may have a wide range of feelings after your abortion. Some may feel relief. Some may feel anger, regret, guilt, or sadness. Catch the next little phrase, for a little while. That's good. Just a little while. Just, you know, it's going to hurt for a little bit. It's going to be fine. You'll be fine. Serious long-term emotional problems after abortion are about as uncommon as they are after giving birth. Thank you, American Psychological Association. You may be more likely to have emotional problems after abortion for certain reasons. Well, having a history of emotional problems before your abortion. That's just what I said. But do they, in fact, screen and counsel and provide extra time? Why? Because they're in the business of abortion, not in examining the well-being and protecting women's health. Having important people in your life who aren't supportive of your decision, well, that makes life difficult, certainly. And having to terminate a wanted pregnancy because your health or the health of the fetus is in danger. Well, I basically agree with Planned Parenthood. Right on. They've got it right. All they have to do now is implement. Do something about this. Provide extra counseling. Refer people out. You know, if you want an abortion in Germany, you can't just go in and say, I want an abortion. You've got to have counseling at an outside, independent agency. Because we eliminate the conflict of interest. And that conflict of interest is significant here. I mentioned this to you earlier. This is just a slide on that. The younger women are more likely to have the highest suicidal risk than older women. And Gissler, who also was a reviewer on the American Psychological Association, recommends 2 to 3 weeks post-abortion a checkup for physical and mental health problems. Now, mind you, this is at a time when the abortion industry is promoting women don't need follow-up after their abortions. Why? Because it takes time. It's expensive. You've got to have a counselor there. How about a medical abortion, RU46, a chemical abortion? The FDA says you have to have a follow-up. Daniel Grossman at the University of Texas at Austin has published work saying we don't need to do that, us abortion providers. Women are fine. They take the abortion pill. Most of them are fine. A few have some problems, but not a big deal. So, again, we're endangering women's health. Do you know, when you compare women who have surgical abortions to women who have chemical or medical abortions, who do you think have higher psychological health risks? The outcomes. Medical. Because they're the abortion provider. They get the pills, but they cause the abortion. They consume RU46. They make it happen. And they go home. And they experience it alone. And in some cases, they experience physically the evacuation of the uterus. And that's not just tissue. Sometimes they actually see. And now the Obama administration has extended the length through the FDA's recent ruling, extended the lengths when we can use chemical abortion. So it's more likely if you get this, you're going to be visited by a dead fetal child between your legs or in the toilet. And that's going to be traumatizing. I have had numerous medical malpractice actions that I've been involved in where I have evaluated the patient who experienced that. And God love them, what a horrific amount of torture they've gone through. So, again, we're exposing women needlessly when we know better. You know, statistics are fine, but these are not statistics. These are real people. All died from abortion. This one hung herself. This one hung herself. This one, I was involved in her medical malpractice case that her father brought against her psychiatrist and the abortion provider. Her name is Stacy. And Stacy lost her life because she had an abortion at Stephen Brigham's clinic. He's a notorious abortion provider who could care less about women's health. And yet, he still owns abortion clinics and is not behind bars. That's what happens. These are real people. Real deaths, real exposure. And this is just the ones we know about, for heaven's sakes. The Center for Disease Control does not have mandatory reporting of death from abortion. Instead, it's part of maternal mortality statistics. But pregnancy-related deaths are not mandatory, and the cause of death is not identified. And many women say to their providers, their healthcare providers, well, I had a miscarriage. They don't talk about the abortion. So we don't really know how many deaths there are in this country. We don't even know how many abortions occur in the United States of America, despite the fact that we've had over four decades of legalization. Is that incredible? The data that's compiled by the Guttmacher Institute, which was a form, an arm of Planned Parenthood, the Guttmacher Institute asks abortion providers to guess how many women they've aborted. Guess? If I asked you to guess how many times you went to Gainesville last year, or how many times you've been to Jacksonville, or how many times, whatever. Guess? That's our data. That's what we think about women's health, reproductive health. And it's ridiculous. We need to do so much more. Just to continue on this topic for a minute, this, if you look at this site down here, this is the National Abortion Federation's Comprehensive Abortion Care, Standards of Care, and it's by Maureen Paul and others, published in 2009. And in this Standards of Care, they talk about what are the risk factors. This is table 5.4. What are the risk factors for emotional sequelae? Again, this is not Human Life International's book or the National Right to Life Committee's or my book that says this is the book on standards of care for abortion providers if you're a member of the National Abortion Federation. Okay, so what do they say? They say you're at risk for negative emotional reactions if you perceive abortion. The outcome of abortion will be stressful. Well, a lot of women think that way. Experiencing social stigma and anti-abortion demonstrators on the day of the abortion. I know of no studies, by the way, that confirm that one. But, I understand why they put it in there. I testified in a case in Texas once. They asked me to come down and do a non-participatory observation, a piece of research for the court. Planned Parenthood had sued those darn pro-lifers who were out there rattling rosaries and praying. Shame on them. They were inflicting trauma. And so I was asked to come in, and unbeknownst to the pro-lifers, I sat in my car and I was taking judicious notes and capturing methodologically what was happening and what I could see. And I did that day after day. And I presented it. And I said, I saw no harassment. I saw no threat. What I did see was the abortion escorts being aggressive with pro-lifers. In a similar case, I testified in Toronto about the harmful effects of prayer on women who were... You're laughing, Phil. I laughed at first, and then I thought, wait a minute, they're serious about this. They're going after people who are praying. And that's why I decided I'm in on this case. I'm in. So I looked at the studies, and I summarized the data for the judge, and I said, Your Honor, there is virtually no evidence in the psychological literature that shows any emotional injury from praying for someone. And in fact, I can show you that there's benefit. And he was shocked. Because the other side said, well, we're traumatizing people. We're politically incorrect. We're injuring people. But the fact is, when you pray for someone, you're wishing them the best. You're asking for intercession. You're asking for God's grace to give them strength. How can that be traumatic? And so we prevailed in that case, thankfully. But I think dark days are ahead for us here, because while that was decided in Toronto, there's a psychology professor at the University of Toronto who is being persecuted right now because he's not going to say politically correct words, and like the transgender issue. And I think increasingly, in fact, there's been one article that has been published that says Vince Rue causes post-abortion trauma because he talks about it. Now, that's pretty powerful. I'd like to think I had that much influence, but there's no way. I started in this by simply asking a question. Tell me about your pregnancy history. And sometimes it took women a month or two to trust me enough to tell me, oh, by the way, I didn't quite tell you everything about my pregnancies. There was an abortion in there. Okay. And so I don't think there's any causation. I think what there is affirmation of this reality. And that, of course, could hurt business pretty badly in the abortion industry. Okay, so back to this. An existing emotional disorder or mental illness prior to the abortion, again, we see it. Ambivalence, perceived coercion, intense guilt and shame before the abortion, belief that the abortion is the same act as killing a newborn. Well, of course it's not a newborn, but one word is right there. It still is causing death. It is killing. But again, consider who's writing this and consider what they're saying. Lack of emotional support, fetal abnormality, all true. Do you know in the literature, if you have a wanted pregnancy and you're told by the genetic counselor or by your obstetrician, you know, I really think for the baby's sake, you need to terminate the life of your child. The literature is crystal clear. That woman, that couple, have intense grief and trauma and need help. And the protocols at the University of North Carolina, for example, are the very same ones I use, though I treat women and men, except one thing is different. This was a wanted pregnancy. This is an unwanted one. And only wanted children can cause grief from an abortion. But that's not true. That's part of the lie. That's deceiving, because wantedness is a construct that goes like this. How many of you have children? Everybody, almost everybody. Okay? Do you ever have a day where you didn't want to have children? They can be a pain in the fanny. But we still love them. But there is this. So wantedness, when you start out with conception and pregnancy, wantedness is not a real good, solid, psychological, stable construct. And yet we know that wanted pregnancies produce trauma and grief and a real tough time for people. Okay, so anyway, look at all these. Unresolved past losses, present or past, sexual, physical, or emotional abuse, pre-existing experience of trauma. Wow. So if you have had sexual abuse in your past, you've had physical abuse, these things are likely to cause problems emotionally. Okay, so if we add up all of these things, and we have 100 women who are going to have an abortion in this room, what percent would not have one of these? Danger. It's even worse when we consider an abortion decision is made under a high degree of pressure. There's a moderately high degree of ambivalence. Conscience is conflicted. There are doubts all over the place. It's crisis management without experience. Conflicted maternal attachment with one's child. Our 2004 study found through multiple regression analysis that one of the significant predictors of post-abortion trauma was attachment to the child. So I'm going to move on because I want to show you something about this. This is a study we did, it was published in 2010. 51% of women and 53% of men had abortion decision conflict. More than half. Abortion decision conflict predicts symptoms of PTSD for women and men. Inadequate pre-abortion counseling predicts relationship problems and PTSD symptoms. And abortion was experienced as high to overwhelming stress by 78% of the women and 71% of the men. This is not my imagination. I'm going to just briefly say something about this. You can look at this later, but you know, the pre-abortion counseling we offer is horrific. In fact, it shouldn't even be called counseling. And in fact, Planned Parenthood knows this, and now they don't even call them counselors. They call them patient advocates, which means decision advocate, which means let's keep things rolling. So what's wrong with it? It's too time limited. It's often group based. There's no pre-procedure meeting with the provider. Misinformed consent is rampant. There's likely misinformation about fetal development and the uterine contents. I was involved in a South Dakota case on informed consent. One of the things we asked Planned Parenthood to provide, I have it as a slide, but not in this particular group, unfortunately. And I took a still shot of what they have a video that they show every woman is going to have an abortion. So it shows, here's the vaginal barrel, here's the uterus. We're going to insert these instruments up into the uterus, and we are going to evacuate the uterus. We looked at it, and there was nothing in the uterus. No one's home. So therefore, rest assured, we're just a gentle scraping and suction. That's misinformation. And it's injurious to women's health. Non-professional counselors doing counseling. In one deposition, we asked an abortion counselor, tell us about your training, please. And she said, well, I didn't graduate from high school. Did not. And where do you work? And where did you work before this? And do you have any other jobs currently? She worked part-time as an abortion counselor. Well, I work at Joe's Bar. So her credentials as an abortion counselor were, one, she's a good listener at a bar, and two, she had an abortion herself. That's the best we offer. She had 4 weeks of training and was herself subject to misinformation. So she's going to continue the pattern, and on it goes. When women are asked to pay for something before they receive the services, they're more likely to follow through, which is exactly why they do that. They're discouraged from looking at alternatives. Even alternatives being brought up, they're often not. And they're encouraged to act immediately. One abortion clinic in Boston, it's actually a chain, if a woman was anxious before her abortion, the abortion counselor would go to the nursing station and obtain a Valium. She would bring it to the woman and administer Valium to the patient. The abortion counselor. Imagine if you or I did that and we're not a nurse or a healthcare provider, a physician. Hello, Houston, we've got some problems. But that's, again, so if you're medicated, you're going to be more likely to just say, okay, go ahead. And there is research that says women that need to be anesthetized for their abortion are more likely, that's a predictor, they're going to have more problems after their abortion. How are we doing time-wise, Phil?
We started late, so we can go on a little bit more.
Okay. This next study is the study that we did in Russia and in the U.S., and I just want to point out that in the U.S., 64% of women felt pressured to have an abortion. Interestingly enough, one out of two in Russia and in the U.S., one out of two felt abortion is immoral. You wouldn't think that in Russia. I was surprised by that, but it's pretty important. Ambivalence, 54. Remember, ambivalence was part of what the National Abortion Federation said? Okay. How about needed more time? Had counseling beforehand? So, was the abortion, pre-abortion counseling adequate? 11% said yep. That means a whole lot of women felt no. Classically, this is the triad we see after an abortion. It may be guilt, it may be grief, or it may be trauma, or it may be all three. Several researchers have said it is axiomatic that women will feel guilt after an abortion. Why does someone feel guilt? Is guilt a bad thing? Guilt is a good thing. It's shame that's a bad thing. What is guilt? Guilt is an acknowledgement that I have done something wrong. It's not like dandruff, but we got to get rid of this stuff. Guilt is feedback. It's part of the feedback loop that says, uh-oh, I just bashed into somebody's car. I feel guilty. That's not a good thing. I need to know I'm acting according to what I believe is the right thing. And then we have moral injury if we don't pay attention to that. This is a whole nother talk, but obviously grief is manifold. Everybody does it differently. And normal grief can be resolved in a month or 12 months. But anything beyond 12 months becomes pathological grief. And there's all different forms. Disenfranchised grief down here basically means that if I'm grieving, but you tell me I'm not, then I'm disenfranchised. Society does not affirm that abortion is a loss and is that it is painful and that you have the right to grieve. Oh, you do if it's a wanted baby, but not if it's an unwanted. So grief is manifold, and women and men can stay in grief for decades. Is abortion traumatic? You tell me. This is the actual criteria in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders 5, published by the American Psychiatric Association. Here's what they say. You got to have, in order for something to be traumatic, it's got to hit all three of these balls. One, you're exposed to actual or threatened death, serious injury, or sexual violence. Well, it seems to me that we have actual death, because if we don't have it, then we don't really have an abortion. Witnessing the traumatic event directly, or learning the traumatic event occurred to a close family member or close friend. Witnessing directly, check. In cases of actual or threatened death, the death must have been violent or accidental. check. Abortions are not peaceful. They're violent. They're not accidental. They're intentional. In my opinion, abortion is a psychosocial stressor capable of causing depression, anxiety, PTSD, whatever way it manifests itself in women and men. Now, why is this important? Because the American Psychiatric Association actually said that in 1986. Abortion is a type of psychosocial stressor. In 1992, we published a study, Ann Speckert and I, on post-abortion syndrome. And it was published in the Journal of Social Issues by the American Psychological Association. And suddenly, the American Psychiatric Association ripped the word abortion out of this DSM-5, which is the Bible for all mental health work. And you won't find abortion in any iteration of the DSM-5 or 4 or 3R. Because our study suggested that it can be traumatic. So what happens? What is post-abortion trauma, and what happens? Well, this picture basically tells the story. The baby was a resident in the uterus and is transplanted in the woman or man's brain. The baby was eliminated, but the connection between the mother and the child, between the father and the child, remains. And why is that? Because if we deny the existence of this little intrauterine traveler, we are going against our natural inclinations to protect, to provide, to love. And we know in our brains, at a very deep level, a very primordial level, that abortion is the death of our offspring. And when that occurs, if we don't acknowledge it, that relationship endures. And it turns into something that's uncomfortable. In fact, it's painful. Women have baby dreams. One woman had, setting the table for her children that were already born, but she and her husband chose to have an abortion, and she set another place. And then she wondered, why did I do that? One woman was flying across the Atlantic from London to New York, and she was very pro-choice. This was published in the London Times. And she said, all of a sudden, midway in the flight, she burst into tears. She was crying and became inconsolable. The flight attendants came to her. Nobody knew what was going on. She realized the anniversary of her abortion occurred that day from a year earlier. What does that mean? It means we're connected inside, and the child is transplanted back into our awareness. And we do all we can to avoid it, and yet the child keeps saying, Mom, Dad, and there's no grief. So there's no goodbye. There's no naming the child. There's no connection to the child. As long as this cycle occurs, which is called intrusion and re-experiencing and avoidance and denial, as long as that's going on, you have post-abortion trauma. Simple as that. And our job, and if you are interested and willing and have the heart for this, our job is to help these women and men find freedom. Find freedom from this torture chamber and find relief that only comes from acknowledging what an abortion is, their role in it, and the beauty of forgiveness and God's mercy. That is what lies before you. And I hope that this will encourage you and interest you to think about this. Certainly pray about it and pray for all those who minister to those women and men who are injured after an abortion. So thank you very much.
For a brief question and answer period, I'll start it out. I was interested in that one statistic you had about half of the women in Russia thought it was amoral, even though. So basically, the removing of the baby from the womb is goes against natural law, because if you think the Russians, a lot of Russians don't, even believe in anything. Why would they think it's amoral, right? I mean, there's something built in, right?
Well, they were not even allowed to believe in anything. The Russian Orthodox Church has existed. Despite tremendous oppression since the Russian Revolution. It was in the 20s. But as the church is also in China, and China's interesting, it's another story, it's a parallel one, because I went over there as well. I'll come back to that in a second. But in Russia, the Russian Orthodox Church went underground. They turned the churches into museums.
That's right.
And they were, desecrated, if you will. But in the last 15 years, they said, wait a minute, why are we doing that? These are national treasures. And Putin has allowed, apparently he has converted two Russian Orthodox. And Patriarch Kirill is strongly pro-life, and he has influenced both the Duma, which is the legislative body, and Putin to saying, look, this is a scourge on our nation. And he doesn't mince words. If you want to read about somebody who's calling it the way it is, check out Google Kirill, Patriarch Kirill. And the Russian Orthodox Church has now grown and expanded, and more people are going to church. And I was shocked in my last trip. I was shocked, because in previous trips, not so much. Yeah. But there's a tremendous influence now going on. So despite the fact that the state had wiped out the churches, and which may be a precursor to what's happening or could happen here, despite that, deep within us is written in our hearts what an abortion is. And we try and listen to people telling us, oh, it's fine, it's okay. It's just a clump of tissue. It's like going to the dentist. But it doesn't quite settle the issue. And that is an enduring problem. In Beijing, when I was over there, I was asked to talk on PTSD. So I did. And I gave as an example, abortion. Beijing Medical University. And I thought, well, should I do this? I will. And, they were polite. Probably 300 or 400 people there. Afterwards, I can't tell you the number of psychiatrists that came up to me and said, we've seen this all the time. But they can't publish it. They can't talk about it. The official organizations in China could not acknowledge it. But China has the highest suicide rate in the world. They also have the most number of forced abortions. And now people are saying, oh, well, that's a chapter that's passed. Guess what? You can now have two kids with permission. But you can't have three. And they still have forced abortions. And they have forced abortions all the way up to birth. So it's very, very traumatic.
We hear so often that it's a woman's health issue. Years ago, when we first formed this organization, we had a fundraiser. I organized it. It was a complete failure. The only person who contributed was my mother, and I had power of attorney over her checking account. Anyway, Dr. Kane, the inventor of Gatorade, he attended this dinner. He's very pro-life. He's dead now. Okay. So Dr. Kane said something to us before he spoke that night. He said, he was a medical school professor. in all the years that I've taught medical school, in all the research that I do, I've not seen a single case, I guess ectopic pregnancy perhaps an exception, where the proper thing to do for a woman's health was to abort the baby. So I said, well, no, what are you supposed to do when a woman's health? He goes, deliver it. And I realized that I myself had a culture of death mentality, where I only thought in terms of, so a lot of, I'm thinking in terms of my young people, they are constantly told that the reason why we need to have the, there's an abortion industry, it exists, is for women's health. But it, how often is a woman's health, maybe it's depression. And if that's the health issue, well, what I've learned from you is that it's going to continue after as well.
And worse.
And worse.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the worst part. And now they're going to be blamed for it. You probably shouldn't have had your abortion. But, you know, it's legal. In some cases, it's free. So, yes. Yes.
That was an excellent review. Thank you. But what Tom was talking about, there's new emerging medical literature about first trimester abortions versus natural miscarriages, and that when you would interrupt a pregnancy that's a healthy pregnancy, we're seeing evidence of increased risk of breast cancer because the hormones want to deliver and the breasts were on the way to being developed, but they weren't. But if the body knows that this is not a healthy pregnancy and it's heading towards a natural miscarriage, it downregulates all of those hormones appropriately. So you don't see that in miscarriages, but you are seeing it in first trimester with their going interruptions, with their abortions.
Right.
So deliver it.
Yeah. That's very good. And Joel Brand is a he's a researcher up at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. And Joel, I've known him for many years, he's been an advocate of abortion and the breast cancer risk and has done the same sort of thing that I've done. He's done meta-analyses and has shown conclusively, if you look at the medical literature, you will see an increased risk of breast cancer when that first pregnancy is terminated. You will see it. So, yes.
Not being a medical psychiatric provider, I'd like your opinion. I have a coworker who has had 3 abortions, and periodically she goes into some kind of depression at work. So I always wonder if I should approach her with the idea, because she has no, well, she makes no connection between her abortions and what she's going through. She chalks it up to stress. Mm-hmm. If I should approach her with that reality, or if she has to approach herself with that reality, would I do more harm, or would it be beneficial?
That's a great question. Mm-hmm. It's very important to not jump on top of people and say, you know what, I think you have post-abortion trauma. We start with where the individual is. She's depressed. So connect to that. Connect to that. Tell her, you know, I just feel so badly for you. Your eyes look like you've got the weight of the world in there. And, you know, if you want to talk, I'm happy to listen. And show the caring. I mean, we have to be representatives of what would Jesus do. He would say, oh, you're depressed? That's nice to see you. You know, he would take the time. He would do that. And that's, and it may not come out for a while. You may be the first person to sit there and listen. And maybe that'll give her some courage that she can actually say what she feels down deep. But it may not happen with you. It may happen down over here. Or somebody else says, you know, I care about your feelings. And she might risk it there. Or it might be in treatment. But the point is, we've got to start there. And we've got to care and put that love in action.
I have another question.
You have another question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Startled by the high rate, the percentage of men that feel guilty over abortion. And I was wondering if there was any connection between whether their guilt was associated with them encouraging the woman to go or them not stopping her, or if there's any kind of studies that are done, what trips that the male reaction?
Well, we've done, as a whole topic, another day of research on abortion and men. And briefly, let me say, yes, a man's role in it can influence his outcome, but it can also go the other way, that he had no role, he was basically supportive of his girlfriend or his wife, and she did it, and he's devastated. And then the relationship is in peril. Some men become the Don Quixotes, and they take off after they find out the woman's pregnant. Others coerce her into an abortion. There's a whole topology of this. But for the ones that do suffer, they, in fact, our research shows some of these guys actually suffer more pain and grief than women. Why? Because they're completely shut into themselves. They don't have friends and girlfriends and anybody to talk to. And they certainly won't share with another guy over a beer at the Florida Gator game. Ain't gonna happen. Guys don't operate like gals do. So it's a problem. Men and abortion is a huge issue. You know, we've been trying to establish a toehold for women's mental health and abortion, and we've been doing the research on men, but it's sort of like a disconnect for a lot of people. But it's men are involved, and there stands to reason they're going to be involved in the after effects. Yes.
I don't know if you know, saw this summer there was a new study from Catholic University of America on
Paul Sullins?
Yes, that guy.
Yeah, that guy.
I guess my question is what. To me, I looked at the study, like, that is the most conclusive from American longitudinal data for exactly what you're talking about. What's it going to take for the AMA, for the APA, to really reevaluate everything? What kind of study is it going to, I guess, ask?
Well, he's referring to Paul Sullins, who's a priest, he's a sociologist at CUA, and he's a great guy. This is his first launch into abortion. He previously has written about same-sex parenting and the psychological trajectory of children. And as you could guess, that has garnered him several barbecues. but good research.
What's his last name?
Sullins. Paul Sullins. Sullins.
Okay.
Good job. That's the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescence to Health. One of the biggest national probability sampling data sets we have in this country, 20,000 plus individuals. And Paul found that, I think the overall increased risk for mental health problems was 45% compared to other outcomes, including unwanted delivery. What's it going to take? I don't think it's going to take studies. I think what it's going to take is people talking. We've tried the studies. Coleman's is impeccable. I think it's going to come from a judge's sister had an abortion and she was devastated. Or somebody's wife, you know, knows this. I think that's from the bottom up. We've tried from the top down. And we're just getting slammed with a media that's unresponsive. When we publish, you won't find Sullins. You won't find that study in the media anywhere. It was buried as fast as it grew up.
We have time for a couple more. Disregarded
when you hear priest as well.
What's that?
It would get disregarded just hearing the word priest as well. Not well, sociologist, like in the general media.
Yes. Well, yeah, exactly. He's got eminent qualifications.
Sure.
He's a solid scientist, but agreed. Tag on the priest and then.
I was a country doctor, okay? And I took care of this girl who was very poor. She was married to a fellow who was, I would say he had a mentality of a six-year-old, okay? Unfortunately, they had, I guess, five or six children. She was the first face delivery that I ever experienced. It was the most traumatic delivery in my life. I'll never forget it, and I still think about it quite often. The child was an anencephalic, and that's the way they usually are delivered. They come with a face presentation. It was an awful delivery. It was terrible. Afterwards, she's a saint, my estimation. I told the nurses just put the baby aside on the table, and you know keep it you know clean and whatever they do in the preliminary. but I prayed inside that the baby would not survive, okay? And it wouldn't. It's very unlikely that the baby would survive. And I felt that all I could do was to tell her that the baby wasn't right, and that but the nurses were good enough to show the baby to the mother with the cover over the head.
Good.
And so that there could be some bonding there.
Exactly.
I continue to see her as a patient, and all I could do for her, and I'm not a psychologist by any means, was just to sympathize with her. And she was, like I said, she's a saintly person in my estimation. She consoled me more than, you know, I could console her. And she got over it, okay? But there's some bonding there between the doctor and the patient. And today there is not that much going on.
Absolutely.
And I'm sorry to say, it's a manufacturing company out there, whatever's going on in the hospitals and stuff. I don't want to say this is a blanket, you know, truth, but those experiences, I had other experiences too I won't go into, but that experience primarily had a lot to do with the way I felt. And I often grieved to think that I couldn't have done more. And I'm not saying this to make polish my own apple, but she for one, was somebody who really impressed me a lot. Mm-hmm. And I was so happy that I was able to be there to help in a situation like that.
I think Anna, of your name.
Yes.
Doctor, you know, being, you know, teaching in school, like the Catholic education, what age is appropriate, you know, where we can kind of pass this information to young people? Because if I got all that information, I'm not going to have abortion, I'm done. what I'm saying is, this needs, this education has to be given to young people.
Yes, it does.
How do we do it?
Well, it's tough because Planned Parenthood has already thought of this, and they're out of the schools.
And I feel very passionate about this.
They're out of the schools, and they won't let this information in because they have the curriculum. And, you know, I think the Vatican even came up with recently, I think it was the Pontifical Council on the Family, came up with a suggested program for sex education for children. I haven't studied it closely, but I thought it was a little disappointing in that they didn't have anything about abortion.
And that's sad. Especially
and that's from the Vatican.
So all I can do is wear this. I vote pro-life.
Yeah. Well, that's why we need to talk about this topic.
It needs to
be talked about with friends. It needs to be talked about with colleagues. Mm-hmm. We need to speak from the mountaintops and say, you know, this is an issue. This is not just, you know, a moral issue. This is a health issue, a public health issue, that we're exposing people to injury needlessly.
There's a question back. Yes.
I don't know, I'm just very confused with all these presidential things. What can a president do about stopping abortion? What is the purpose that president has to stop abortion?
Well, if you take that in the opposite, what can a president do to promote abortion?
Yeah.
Look at the last 8 years.
Yeah.
Our president has been the most supportive of abortion that we've ever seen.
Exactly.
And
well,
and so what can a president do? A president, if they can promote it, they can defund it. They can encourage and pull it out of the federal bureaucracy.
Well, that's how I'm coming from, where I'm coming from. If those two presidents, you know, lately they've been talking a lot about how powerful it will be if they, you know, Obama or Hillary, how it's going to be for each to be elected. But how come any Republican haven't had the power to do good about abortion, you know, to do more good than harm?
The last
the
last Republican administration to really be pro-life was Reagan.
Yeah.
And I was a consultant to C. Everett Koop, his Surgeon General. And he did a study, but that's been all misinterpreted, but that's another story. But the president yields a tremendous amount of power as from his bully pulpit, from his moral underpinnings, from his encouragement of people. If the president, based upon scientific evidence, discouraged people from having an abortion, as Putin is doing, believe it or not, I can't believe I'm making this comparison, but as Putin is doing, he is saying, look, this is not a good thing. He has now passed a law in the Duma that said, I will not allow advertising for abortions. So,
yeah, Peter Dompelier, a clinical pathologist in this parish, told me to table over there. Peter is in charge of transfusion services at University of Florida Medicine. And he told me about chimerization, where the DNA of the baby actually passes into the mother.
Right.
And we know that this happens with red blood cells because in Rh-positive babies, red cells get in the mom and then she makes antibodies that kill the red blood cells in the baby. So there's blood cells going one way and antibodies going another. Peter told me that from the baby DNA, whether it's a full-term baby, a miscarried baby, or an aborted baby, gets into the mother and actually becomes part of the mother's DNA.
Correct.
So that...
That's the biological mechanism of this.
And that, and that could be baby on the bone marrow.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, so whether that mom tries to disenfranchise herself from that baby or not, that baby is part of her chemistry, part of her biology.
Yes.
Whether she carries it for a term, it's naturally miscarried, or it's an elective abortion. And I don't know how that might play into... abortion counseling. But you can ask Peter about it. He knows more about that, being a blood bank MD transfusionist. I just thought it was very interesting.
Yeah, I understand there's actually a protective effect of that fetal chimerization that occurs for, it's a beneficial effect for the mother.
It can be, yeah.
Which is unbelievable when you think about that. Here I have ended your life, but you're residual DNA
lives on in me.
Is not only living on in me, but helping protect me and give me help. Wow.
Isn't that what mercy is?
Exactly.
I'm reminded our scripture reading last Sunday was of the Pharisee and the publican, how careful we must be not to be like the Pharisee and say, well, look at that poor publican over there. I must be better than he. Jesus said, which one of those went away justified in God's sight?
Okay, we have to take a little break, okay? Mary Catherine, our next speaker is here, but I'm sure that, Dr. Wu, will you entertain a few questions privately?
Absolutely. Okay, and here are the handouts for you, so
I'm sorry,
by all means,
we don't get moving, we're never going to get to the bench.
Grab some of these.
So,
thank you, doctor. I'm going to go to the next one. Talk about invasiveness. I'd like to see what the
during the procedure.
That's good.